Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musicians.
From Hollywood This Week, inside Format Entertainment, this is Score the Podcast. I'm Kenny Holmes.
Robert Kraft.
He's Robert Kraft.
So great to be here in the heart, the engine room of the soundtrack to many, many of our favorite movies.
Yes, we also want to introduce our executive producer, Matt Schrader.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
There's Robert Kraft.
Ooh, oh, wow. Nice new drop for us this week.
It's amazing.
This is amazing.
We have a really cool guest this week, and we are expanding our format a little bit. We're in the offices of Dave Jordan. He is the music supervisor of all music supervisors in Hollywood.
Basically the number one music supervisor.
And yep. He's been in charge of some of the biggest films of the last, definitely of the last 10 years, the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise, Captain America, First Avenger, all the big Marvel movies, Guardians
Black
of the
Panther,
Galaxy 1 and 2, Black Panther,
Daredevil, Elektra,
Ant-Man and the Wasp,
Iron Man.
So many big ones. And he's a huge comic book collector. Yep. So it's kind of come full circle for
also,
him.
Also, we should mention television, too. Empire, just for example.
Yeah, so we're going to dive in a little bit about what a music supervisor does so you can sort of know what to expect. But super important process of the filmmaking world, and we're lucky to be in the offices of the biggest guy in the game.
Dave Jordan.
He's a legend that's still becoming more legendary.
Wow.
Plus, we have an all-new episode of The Inside Track with Dr. Sulan Tan. This week's episode is The Ocean Depths, and it's a really interesting study that Dr. Sulan Tan goes into about how music can manipulate your feeling of what you're seeing on the screen. And she kind of goes into that in different ways on all the different episodes, but this is a really interesting example of they did a fundraiser and played different types of music, and the way people were steered in a direction based on the music that was chosen. It's a really interesting psychological experiment.
It's a scientific way of showing music actually turning people's the way that someone interprets the music and a scene that they watch, which is really, really interesting.
Sounds
like 5 pounds of cheese.
And, of course, another chance for our audience to win a fabulous prize. We're playing Name That Score with Dave Jordan. And today's topic, Matt.
Famous movie songs. We did this a few weeks ago with Tamar Cali. Now we're doing a version two.
Round two.
Of this.
So. Well, if anyone knows famous music songs, it should be Dave Jordan.
Yeah.
Music supervisor.
He's the guy. We'll put these are all, I think, going to be before his time, but I'm sure he knows them all. So.
All right. So we're going to get into what a music supervisor does in just a second, but we were having this discussion about reboots and spin-offs and different shows and movies. So we all came up with our long overdue reboots and or spin-offs that should be made or maybe even are already being made.
Yeah, I mean, most look, every movie, Robert, you were talking about this, all kinds of studios, there's almost departments dedicated to what's another movie that's like this movie that we did. Can we do a sequel? Can we do a prequel?
The hype's already there. It's
actually
almost marketed already.
There's a word for it, which our audience should know. The word is pre-awareness. You look for a pre-awareness title, meaning you don't have to explain everything about the movie. For example, if I said to you these words, we're going to do the Lego movie, you might think, what is that movie going to be about? But you already have an idea. It's Lego. If I say I'm going to do
existing
a Batman
franchise
movie, you know, an Iron Man movie,
you don't have to market it. It's
so
already
we've got
there.
A couple that we've gone through that are good. Robert, you have your list in front of you there?
I do. Well, first of all, at the top of my list would have to be the sequel to the movie that I worked on many years ago that has found an audience slowly. That's Hudson Hawk. I always felt that Hudson Hawk 2 would have as big a cult following as Hudson Hawk.
That movie got a lot of extra love at the Bruce Willis roast.
Bruce Willis roast? It's actually, I think we might have the most number of raspberries, which is worst movie awards.
Oh, wow.
It's just, you know, it's a... What do they call it? An acquired taste. Mm. So I think that would be top. I also was thinking about you could do movies like, for example, take The Graduate. You could do The Postgraduate.
Oh.
Where Dustin Hoffman is now deeply in debt, trying to pay back his college loans. He's now, you know, 80 and still hasn't paid them back. And I'm not entirely sure where the movie goes from there, but it had such an...
But he's paying bills.
Paul Simon could clearly yeah, write the song.
He's in debt.
He's in debt. He's paying bills. And he's probably having an affair. I'm not sure with who, because Mrs. Robinson at this point would be 100.
Yep.
So
she's long gone.
Long gone. But, you know, if you guys, as they say it in a studio... Bring it back to me.
Well, those are the two very serious things that I think studios should consider now. You also had one other that I'm eyeing on your list there.
Which one? Is it Sit By Me? Well, Sit By Me would be the Stand By Me kids have grown much older. They're now all in wheelchairs. And they find a dead, some roadkill. That's where I'm going.
Some roadkill.
And they wheel their wheelchairs up to it.
Kenny, what do you have?
Well, I took a little more serious approach to this, somewhat.
Serious.
The first one I think should be made, and I think is already rumored of being made after I did a little research, but I think it would be really cool to have a Matrix prequel to show...
There's been a little bit of chatter about maybe them starting to
it's
work
It's been
on
thrown something. Thrown around a little bit. Another one I'd like to see made, just because the comedy troupe has kind of not been around in the same movie together in a while, but it would be cool to do Old School 2, maybe New School.
Nice.
Get Luke Wilson and...
Sophomore year.
Will Ferrell and Vince Vaughn, all those guys
pretty
back
fresh.
Together. I don't know. Maybe it's past its time. Maybe it wouldn't work, but I think it'd be worth a shot. That movie was kind of game-changing in the comedy world. It brought Will Ferrell and that group, Vince Vaughn, those guys kind of to the forefront of comedy movies.
Great.
When it comes to TV, I think it would be really cool to have a Jesse Pinkman Breaking Bad spinoff.
Nice.
Post-Walter White.
Cool.
Maybe Post-Walter White.
Maybe we could call it Science. Mr. White.
You know, you might want to call
That's
it something
good.
Like
That's a pretty
Mathematics.
Good
Yo, bitch. Sorry, I'll bleep that out.
Now we need that E on our... it's going to say explicit next to the episode. Thanks a lot.
And then my last one, this is a bonus one that I think many people have requested we do, and that would be score a film music documentary to legends that keep becoming more legendary.
I am so down
He's
for
a
that.
Legend that's still becoming more legendary.
I am so down for score two.
So those are my picks. Matt, what do you got?
Oh, well, I made a couple of these. I wasn't sure if we were going to get to them. These now sound way too serious because you guys are really... Tron, a third Tron movie would be great. Tron Legacy had that killer score and soundtrack from Daft Punk and Trapanese that was just fantastic. And then a Spielberg movie, which his movies have a long history of being made into sequels that somebody else directs and they don't quite live up to... what the original
Ooh,
was.
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this.
Minority Report
yep.
was great. And a sequel to that, prequel to
that. I love
that
idea.
You can't really redo it, I don't think, at this point. But
would you have Tom Cruise?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's set in the future or something, you know, and it'd be really interesting. And the other one that I was throwing around is Beverly Hills Cop. Wouldn't it be great to have Eddie Murphy come back?
Something. Maybe you could have Michael Stein play the song with a banana.
Yeah.
Okay. And like I think on that note,
pretty fresh.
If you follow our Instagram account, you know what I'm talking about. He brought it up in the episode and we found the video.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
That sounds like 5 pounds of intense and amazing fun.
Indeed it does.
Wow.
All right. Well, that was it.
We got a drop for everything.
I'm
now.
Still working
on
postgraduate.
So
what happens in the middle?
Our guest this week, Dave Jordan, music supervisor. Sounds like it'd be someone in charge of the composer. But as somebody, Matt and I both, we don't come from the Hollywood
can I just say,
world.
The title music supervisor, Robert, sounds so boring. A supervisor, they supervise. They what do? They supervise.
Hey, music, everyone, sit in line.
Right.
I'm here.
Tell us what a music supervisor does.
It's so interesting because music supervisor is such a highly creative job and a difficult job and one that's really misunderstood. So many people come to me and say, I'm so good at picking songs that have certain moods. Shouldn't I be a music supervisor? And you want to say, that is such a minor part of this. As Dave will always say, it's hugely political, because what you're doing, as we all know, movies have evolved beyond just being scores where there's an instrumental, you know, what people like to call right. background music.
Right. There's pop songs.
There's now sometimes a dozen pop songs, sometimes 20 pop songs, and a big soundtrack is part of the movie.
Yep.
Someone has to be in charge of that. I'm not sure if supervisor describes that gig very well.
And, well, be in charge of means what? Are they talking with the director? Or are they talking
They're
with the
right
artist?
They're right in the middle of a... If you can picture a supervisor, the music supervisor is having conversations with the director. It's his movie. He wants these songs. The supervisor's then going back to the studio to say, can you afford these songs? Do you like these songs? Is this your vision of the movie that you want to produce and make? And then he's also going to all the record companies to say, the director wants a song by, I'm making it up, The Police in this song. So he has to go and say, can we license that song into the movie? And the Police say yes or no, or their publisher says yes or no. And if they say no, well, we got to go find another song. So it's a mad scramble.
And sometimes there's original songs, quite often,
a lot,
that are created, and they go out and get a bit like Kendrick Lamar for Black Panther, for example, which we're going to ask Dave about how that came about. And even a whole separate soundtrack was created aside from the score for the film that was almost an album. It was a complete album from Kendrick Lamar, and that was stamped with the Black Panther logo on
it. Now, we're breaking a little bit of what we've done in the past. We've mostly talked with composers, but can you tell us about how a music supervisor relates to a composer as well?
Sometimes they never speak during a film, not for any antagonistic reason. They're doing different things. The director's saying, I want original movie score for these scenes, and for these scenes, I want what are called needle drops, songs to play. So the music supervisor, the great ones, are involved in both. They are working with, understanding with the composer where he's going to end his cue, and the song's going to start, and the song's going to end, and the original score is going to start. Sometimes they're just really separate activities. So,
kind of like Guardians of the Galaxy, you have Tyler Bates doing the score, and
exactly
then
right.
you have an entire album of
Dave
popular
Jordan.
Songs that Dave Jordan worked with James Gunn on, I imagine, which, again, we're going to ask him about that film, too, because that's one of his biggest projects.
And there's one final part of a music supervision job, which is rarely acknowledged, which is on a movie like, for example, Titanic, where you have on-screen music. You have the band playing on the Titanic. You have people dancing below the hold to kind of tambourine. You know, there's that whole scene.
That has to be created.
Somebody has to create it and supervise it. And the music supervisor is often very creatively creating original source music that's on screen. So in addition to picking songs, they have to create the musical scenes in the movie.
Well, I'm certainly excited about this conversation because, again, you know, when we talk to composers, a lot of the questions, you know, they can be answered in different ways, but you sort of know of what the answer is to a point. With this, the music supervisor, this is all a new avenue for me, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners. So this is going to be exciting to talk with Dave.
Yeah, man.
So, again, we're here inside Format Entertainment. Coming up after the break, we're going to invite Dave into his own office. Dave Jordan, in charge of many of the biggest Marvel films over the last 10 or 15 years, and many other films as well. He's a music supervisor. This is Score the Podcast. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, Robert Kraft, and I'm inviting you to check us out on Twitter for the latest from the show, giveaways for Name That Score, videos, maybe even a new track from that pop superstar, Jordan Bieber. Check out our handle on Twitter at Score the Podcast. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast. We're here inside Format Entertainment in Hollywood with our guest this week. He's the name of all names for music supervisors, Dave Jordan. Thanks for having us in your studio.
He's also my main gazane, DJ. We are so lucky to be here with Dave, who really has invented, in some ways, the field of music supervision for the 21st century. I don't think that's too exaggerated. I mean, When we first met, were you focused on music supervision as a career? Was that your goal, or was it something you were experimenting with as one possible way to go in the music industry?
So I came to Hollywood chasing my dream of being in the record business. And like everybody who comes to LA chasing their dream in the record business, I wanted to do A&R. I wanted to sign bands. I wanted to find the next big hits. And I was fortunate enough to build my career up and do that exact thing for Atlantic Records and then Universal Records. And while I was at Universal, I also fell into this position of helping put together soundtracks. And this was in the 90s when every single movie had a soundtrack, whether there was any music in the movie or not, we would the label would run around. They'd get the rights to the film to do the soundtrack, and we'd run around and get unreleased B-sides and overcuts from every artist that was on the charts, and that would be the soundtrack. And while I was doing that process, every once in a while I would interact with a person called a music supervisor. And one time I was talking to them and I said, "What exactly is it that you do? Because I'm putting together the soundtracks." And they would say, "Well, I work for the filmmakers and I put the songs in the movie and work on the music and work with the people who are singing on camera, et cetera, et cetera." And a light bulb went off in my head. And it was like finding out that I could be a professional astronaut all of a sudden. Like there was a way for me to get to the moon.
Like you had the abilities and you didn't even know it.
Exactly. And I thought, so let me get this straight. You put music into film and somebody pays you for that job? I literally couldn't believe it, which is the same thing I get from a lot of interns who come in and they say, So I went down that course, and that's a whole nother story of how I progressed there. But I came into contact with you, Robert, when you were at Fox, because I was in the same social circles as several of the people who worked for you, several of the disciples who worked for you, Daniel Diego and Julia Michaels and Knobloch, Mike Knobloch. So that's kind of how we started to interact.
I looked at your list of credits, and I was amazed to see not only how many we've done together, but that the first one, and I don't know if it predates it because sometimes movie release dates on IMDb don't reflect when we worked on the movie, but the first one is the epic. You know, if you look at a list of great American films, you get Citizen Kane. Often you get The Godfather.
Oh boy.
And then I think number three is usually Dude, Where's My Car?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of gets right up there. Was that the first one or was Daredevil? Do you remember?
I was working for a guy named Happy Walters.
Oh, my goodness. I forgot.
Yes, I was working for a guy named Happy Walters, and this little movie called Dude, Where's My Car? Came along, and it was a super low-budget-y thing, and it was about two stoners. And,
exploded.
Yes, and so because I was there, I kind of ended up on that movie, which was an amazing experience, and the director's a guy named Danny Liner, and we had a blast. We had no money. And we had to come up with ideas. And
I can't remember one song, Dude, Where's My Car? I mean, I just...
Oh, my God.
I do not remember. I do remember that you did such a good job, whatever the songs were, and the movie did so well, that I guess Daredevil was number two.
So I left shortly thereafter, probably a year, 9 months after I did that movie. I decided to leave Happy because I was burned out working for him. And I got a phone call from you 10 days before I was going to leave. And you said, "Hey, I hear a rumor you're going to leave Happy Walters." And I said, "Yes." And you said, "Well, what are you going to do when you leave?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm just got to get out of here." And you said, "Well, listen, I have a movie that if you help me out on, I will help you get I will put you in the rooms of some bigger movies and you'll get a shot to pitch on those." And the movie was this movie called Behind Enemy Lines. And here's the...
That's amazing.
And I'll tell you the story because it's an amazing story, which is I did this movie Behind Enemy Lines, which I did in like 2 weeks. It was a financial issue. They wanted a U2 song and we needed songs.
I was telling them about this yesterday. I couldn't remember whether you were on it.
Yes. And that
you want to tell the tale just for a minute that they wanted the director, John Moore.
Yep.
Let's tell it together. He wanted Elevation by U2.
Yep.
And they wanted something like $500,000 for the track. And we didn't have it anywhere near the music budget. And I was freaking out because the movie was closing and John Moore was stamping his feet. And I think you found... Jaguar.
Yes.
Whatever it was.
Yes.
That's one of the specialties of a great music supervisor is the director shows up and says, I need to have a song that's very particular. And you say to him very gently, you can't afford it or we can't get it. You know, the Led Zeppelin won't let us have that song in the movie. Then the music supervisor, the head of the studio or the director or the producer turns to the music supervisor and says, you're going to earn your keep right now because you got to find something to replace this song that makes the director happy, that fulfills the dramatic needs of the moment. And great music supervisors, I mean, there's nobody that's ever seen Behind Enemy Lines that sees that plane taking off from the aircraft carrier in that scene and thinks, man, if only there was a really expensive U2 song here, that movie would be better. It works great.
And every director and every editor puts U2 in the movie or AC/DC. My whole career has been replacing AC/DC. I mean, that's been my career. And so it's, I don't want to say it's cheap, but it's an easy way to get a great movie moment, to put a Rolling Stones song or to put a U2 song or whatever. And that's why they're effective, but a big part of our job is to replace those songs.
How many times do you sit down or get a cut of a movie and there's some song that you absolutely are sure there's no way they can afford it? Like, is that pretty common?
Very common. It's extremely common. The editor, a lot of times, just to help their cut, and because there's certain, you know, AC/DC is a great example of this. It's very hard to replace AC/DC. It just does a certain thing. So the editor, just trying to find the movement within the sequence or the montage, will put AC/DC in there. And you're like, okay, yes, what do you know? Back in Black works in the sequence. What do you know? And so it's a process to pop it out.
Does that make your job harder, though? Because, like, similar with a temp track, when a director gets sold on the sound of something, they're set on that. And then your job is to come in and say, we got to use something else. But they're already so hard set on something. Like, how much of a pain is that? As soon as you hear that, you're like, oh, God, AC/DC.
Do you know you're going to have to be the bearer of bad news?
That's the job.
Yep.
That is the job.
It's so true.
Front line, and I can tell you many, 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 many stories of, again, replacing things like AC/DC or Zeppelin, where they have Immigrant Song in there, and you're like, okay. And they're like, isn't it great? And you're like, it's Immigrant Song. Of course it's great. And, you know, you may have to go through 100, 500, 1,000 songs to find a replacement. Just part of the job.
With your job, there's a lot of, like, budgets and you know, business side of things. But how focused do you have to be on just the charts and pop culture? Like, are you dialed into the radio 24/7 and MTV and pop culture, social media? Because that's probably a big draw for putting an artist on a soundtrack, is how popular they are and how much they can elevate the film, right?
Yeah. You know, most people think that music supervisors just pick up playlists. And yes, that is a part of the job. That's the part of the job we love. It's also 25% of the job.
Hmm.
I always like to say 25% is the pure creative aspect. 25% is the legal side, clearance and, budgets and details, a lot of I's, a lot of crossed T's. And 50% is politics. 50% is dealing with, you work for a studio who's paying you, but you work for the director. A lot of times the studio and the directors don't agree. Sometimes the producers don't agree with the directors. Sometimes all of those parties don't agree with each other. On top of that, you have a veneer of a record label who might have paid $500,000 for the rights, who have their own agenda for what the soundtrack should sound like. And you have to walk out of there having everybody happy, first and foremost, your filmmakers, because that's who
I want you to explain a little bit something that you and I understand after doing it so long, but you just mentioned that the record company is invested. So if I laid it out this way, let's say, for example, I'm making a movie at Fox and our music budget is, I'm going to make it up, $500,000. That has to include the composer, the cost of recording. Somebody sings happy birthday and now you have to pay for it, and somebody sings some silly song that's public domain but you have to go record it, and somebody has to pay for that recording session. But the record label shows up, a record label or three record labels show up and say, we think there is a great soundtrack to be had for this movie. It's Borat. It's Garfield. It's a Marvel movie or some kind of Garden State, 500 Days of Summer. A record company often will call the studio and say, we read that you're making this movie. We're going to give you some money and our artists. How does that confuse the politics where you already just said you have a director who has a point of view for his movie? You have a studio that has a point of view for the movie they're making. I've actually had the experience, maybe you have, which is really strange.
This is the longest. I'm trying to draw this scenario out right
yes,
now.
Yes, I'm trying to explain how record
I know the
work.
Exact scenario he's asking.
Yes, that's why. The I think I'm done. I'd like to talk about some other things. The sometimes the movie star shows up and it tells you he has a favorite band. I turn the microphone over to you and I'm going to go take a nap.
Please, please.
How do you deal with the label?
I have a very simple philosophy on this that's evolved over time. And I'm blessed that I get to work with a place like Marvel. Marvel takes the position on these things that the movie comes first and everything else is ancillary. Which is, I believe, how we get the highest quality music in our movies. And when the soundtracks come out, they're directly connected to the project, as opposed to two of the songs in the movie, but there's 12 songs on the soundtrack, or they're being pushed into the movie. So Kevin Feige runs Marvel. All decisions are based on what's the best perfect thing for the movie. You talk about 500 Days of Summer. You talk about Garden State, soundtracks like that. Those are primarily driven by what was great for the movie first. I mean, you can talk specifically about those movies. But that's how I like to approach it. I loathe doing soundtracks that are just an additional piece of business attached to a film. Because the way I look at it is the film might be a $50,000 to $100,000 to $200,000 to $300,000 investment on from a studio perspective. What's the investment on a soundtrack? On the high end, it's $1 million or $2 million, which pales to the marketing budget on the film. So the film has to be served first. So the way I like to approach it, if I can, is I try to serve the movie first. We test the movie. We have our numbers in our pocket. And then if we have a soundtrack partner, we try to find a soundtrack partner that can offer something besides money. Money's important.
Like what else?
A lead single. An artist that fits with you can't always get it, but an artist that fits with what the film is about, what it's as pure play as you can get it to be. Because if not, you end up with a bunch of second singles by B-level artists that they're trying to break off the back of the movie. And the studio on a certain level is somewhat beholden because they've taken their money, whether it's $500,000 or $1 million, you know, it depends what it is. But it can be very, very complicated. I like to sit with my director first and say, okay, we're looking at being in business with this label or these two labels. They've come to us, they want to do this. Here are their artist lists. Are there artists on these lists you find appealing? Well, yes, I love Michael Jackson. Okay, great. If we couldn't get Michael Jackson, what would be your second pick? And I try to get a gauge on where their head's at. And then when I interact with my studio partners, I say, well, this is kind of what the director likes. Let's press the label to commit not only the money, but artist one, two, or three, and give them a range, not just we have to have Kesha, right? Give them some flexibility because they can't always deliver their A-level artist.
You talked a little bit about
dance. It's a dance.
Working with Marvel, and we couldn't help but notice when we walked in here that you have what looks like every comic book ever created.
Yeah, in your office. We got to talk about this a little bit. This runs deep. Because this is something as a kid that you were a fan of.
Is this just serendipitous? Like, can you tell us about your love for comics and then now how you're an integral part of Marvel now?
And we'll put a couple photos on our website. But you were telling us about your collection as a kid, right?
So this will lead actually to how Robert was so instrumental in my relationship with Marvel. So I did this movie Behind Enemy Lines, which was, I don't want to say a favor. I got paid no money, but Robert said, you know, help me out on this. It's kind of a mess, and I'll put you in some rooms and see if you can pitch and see if you can get a movie. And the movie he put me in the room on, the first one, was for Daredevil, the one, the Ben Affleck movie. Mm-hmm. And I didn't deserve to be in that room. The other supervisors all had much bigger credits than me. And I knew I wasn't going to get the movie, but I knew that I had a passion for the character of Daredevil. I'd collected Daredevil when I was a kid. I was a Marvel guy. And the crazy thing was I spent, you know, days and days leading up to burning CDs. Back then we had to burn CDs. I made all this, you know, these lists and all these characters and ideas and Kingpin and everything. And I went and sat with the director and I told him, oh, by the way, I grew up with Daredevil. And so the director and I talked for 45 minutes about the character of Daredevil. We never talked about music. And he said to me, you know, you should do this movie. And I said, oh my God, I would love to do this movie. And we shook hands. Then the producer was Gary Foster. Director was Mark Steven Johnson. I've done many movies for both of them, 5-6 movies. And I walked out of the room and I grasped the door handle as I was walking out. I had my messenger bag full of CDs. And I realized I haven't given any music to the director. And like any good music supervisor, you realize if you give music they don't like, you're screwed and you're not going to get the movie. So I took the yes and walked out of the room.
Take yes for an answer.
I took the yes for the answer. And that led many, many steps to this. But that led to a relationship with a guy named Avi Arad, who at the time ran Marvel. And his right-hand guy was a guy named Kevin Feige, who now runs Marvel.
Uh-huh. So 9-year-old Dave Jordan got you the Daredevil.
100%. I called my mother after I got that movie, and I said, remember all that money I used to steal from your purse to get comic books?
Well, it paid off.
I said, guess what? If we play our cards right, I can buy you a house.
And now you have episode one of Daredevil on your wall.
So I had 95% of my comic books before work, and I only collected Marvel, which is serendipitous. But after I got on to these movies, each one I would buy the first appearance of the character when I worked on the movie. So that's how I acquired the higher end books over time. It was like my gift back to myself.
They didn't just hook you up. It's Marvel.
has changed over the years, but for a very long time, Marvel was considered the cheapest company to do business with. And they gave me nothing. But it's evolved over time. Now they're very generous.
They've done
to
a couple
people.
Now.
It's worked out for them.
I think the best part of the story is the fact that you didn't give any music. I just love that. And it just really shows that all the preparation you have to get a job, sometimes it's another part of your character, your life, your story that gets you the gig.
Well, I think that's exactly right. But it's also discovering music with a filmmaker who you've sat with for 10 minutes. It's a process. Everything's a process. It's the same thing with composers, right? This is called the score. Composers have the same problem. They want to work on a Marvel superhero movie, but they only have comedy credits or indie movies. It's very hard for them to sell in a room unless they can make a connection with the filmmakers why they are the right person.
Right.
So it's the same type of, I think I could have given the director a bunch of stuff and he could have said, oh my God, I hate hip hop. Oh, that would have been the end of the party.
Well, we're going to get to three of Dave's biggest films that he's worked on, Black Panther and the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise, when we come back. But first, the inside track.
The Inside Track with music psychologist Dr. Soolon Tan.
When I was a child, I spent hours poring over books about marine life, pondering what it must be like to dive deep and explore the bottom of the ocean. So I've always loved underwater documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
That was an excerpt from a live recording of Hans Zimmer's music for Blue Planet 2, the documentary series about marine life. Nature documentaries pose some real challenges for filmmakers. Good sound is difficult to capture in the wild. In particular, when filming in an undersea environment, there are many added challenges. The ocean is teeming with life, noisy life. Marine mammals, fish, crabs, shrimp all make sound. And water is a very good conductor of sound. So even noises of ships that are miles away can be picked up. As the water's flat surface above reflects sound back like a ceiling, there are also a lot of echoes in shallower waters. So the filmmaker gives us a scaled-down, more focused version of this rich swirl of natural sounds. And music is often added as a backdrop to provide an emotional connection and to give us a feeling of what it's like to be immersed in this underwater world. And just as in narrative films, the score can influence the way we respond to scenes in nature documentaries. In 2016, for instance, a group of researchers played scenes of sharks from a documentary film and added different music tracks. One track was entitled Sharks from the original Blue Planet soundtrack by George Fenton, which they labeled as ominous music. The other piece was Blue Planet by George Fenton from the same soundtrack, which the researchers labeled as uplifting music. The researchers found that when the nature scenes were shown with ominous music, viewers perceived the sharks more negatively as more scary, dangerous, and vicious than those who saw the same shark scenes with uplifting music or no music. In comparison, those who saw the shark scene with uplifting music or without music perceived the sharks as more peaceful, beautiful, and graceful. At the very end of the study, the participants were told that the research team would make a small donation to an ocean conservation fund. They asked each participant to vote for where the money should go. Should it go to a fund dedicated to protecting dolphins, or to protecting sharks, or to a miscellaneous fund? A significantly larger proportion of people who had watched the shark scene with the uplifting music selected the fund to help sharks, compared to those who'd watched the scene without music. The study was conducted by Dr. Andrew Nosel and colleagues at UC San Diego. And true to their word, the researchers donated to the fund receiving most votes. We can't necessarily conclude that the participants would have reached into their own pockets, as they were simply choosing where to allocate funds. But this gave a real-world dimension to the study and some insight into how the presence of music may have shaped attitudes. A lot of skill goes into the music and sound design of effective nature documentaries. And the music can give an emotional arc to the film, set the tempo or pace of a natural scene that's unfolding before us, and showcase the most spectacular moments, whether we're soaring high above the earth or exploring the depths of the ocean.
Dr. Soolon Tan is a leading researcher in the study of film music and the author of many books, including her latest, Psychology of Music, From Sound to Significance, available now at score-movie.com/podcast.
Welcome back to Format Entertainment with our guest this week, music supervisor extraordinaire Dave Jordan. And
the music supervisor.
The music supervisor of all music supervisors. We touched a little bit on Marvel, but we wanted to save the big films for this block. And I want to start with Black Panther. You had Ludwig Göransson do the score and compose some really cool kind of hip hop trap mixed with orchestral stuff. But then there was also a separate soundtrack that was a Kendrick Lamar album. Now, when you're working with a huge pop star like Kendrick Lamar, are you involved on the creative process of what these songs are because they're stamping the Black Panther and Marvel names on it? Or is that, Kendrick, do your thing, you're a huge pop star, whatever you do is going to be successful, so we'll take it from there? Like, how does that process work?
So every movie is a little different. And this one is no different in that it was a very different process, but a very pure process in a lot of ways. And what I mean by that is the director is a guy named Ryan Coogler, mm-hmm. who had done Fruitvale Station and Creed and had enormous credibility and was a very exciting filmmaker for Marvel to get in business with. And Ryan had gone to college with Ludwig Göransson.
Right.
And they had become very good friends in college. And Ryan told me the whole story late one night during a session. He told me the whole story about how when Ryan became kind of an it guy in Hollywood, Ryan still lives in Oakland. And his agent was saying, you got to get out to LA. Everybody wants to meet you. Everybody's talking about this movie. Everybody's talking about Fruitvale Station. And he came out to LA. He didn't know anybody. And so he slept on Ludwig's couch. And so they, in a lot of ways, Ludwig is kind of Ryan Coogler's muse.
And I didn't know any of this.
It's an unbelievable relationship they have. When we were working on we got into post on the movie. I'll talk about Kendrick, but when we got into post on the movie, Ryan would cut the movie and work on the movie all day long, and then he would go to Ludwig's studio at 10, 11 o'clock at night, and then work till 3 or 4 in the morning. Like, Ryan never slept. It was crazy. When we were scoring the movie, we scored in London, and the sessions would take place overnight because we were monitoring the sessions in London, and it would be 3 o'clock in the morning, and Ryan would be there through the entire sessions.
Wow.
Till 10 o'clock in the morning. And then he would go back to editing room. So they're very, very tight. And Ludwig's fiance and Ryan's wife are very close. And so they're a close knit clan. We had brought Ludwig in very early and talked about, you know, the way Marvel likes to do things, the way we have an accelerated process, the way our movies are constantly being edited. So we understood the relationship that Ryan and Ludwig have, and so our job was to surround them and support them and do what they wanted to do. 2 days before Christmas, I got a call from Ludwig, my first movie with Ludwig, and he was in Africa. And he was like, I've been traveling all over Africa and I'm recording Baba Mall and I need money. And it was like, no problem. Let's get this guy sorted out. So, and he was, you know, paying guys and having them sign pieces of paper in Africa. And it was a very exciting process. The Kendrick part of it is, for me, is really a dream come true. When I sat with Ryan, we started to talk about, very early on, we started trading lists back and forth. And Ryan had made it very clear that he wanted to have a broad soundtrack for the film and for the actual physical record. And we started to talk about a lot of what's going on the continent, and he had been doing a lot of research and all this kind of great music that was coming off the continent. But the one through line that kept coming back to him was Kendrick Lamar. And I said, if you could have any one artist, who would it be? And he said, Kendrick Lamar. And we're so fortunate at Marvel that we've had enough movies that people are aware of our brand. Mm. So we can get to a lot of people. The conversation's a lot easier than it normally is.
Was the first reaction, who else would you want? Because when you talk about someone at the top of the list, that's kind of a...
We talked about three different artists, but easily Kendrick Lamar was the choice. Mm-hmm. And I had great experience representing Marvel to the music community that I felt this is a conversation. This is a real conversation. Let's have this conversation. And so eventually we got to a point where we got Kendrick into a room with the director and his manager and I don't think at the time Kendrick knew while he was there. I think he was being pulled in a million different directions.
Yeah.
And I don't think he knew why he was there. And so we're sitting there, and pretty early in the conversation, Ryan, who's a very humble person, just like Kendrick Lamar. I mean, they're like two of this two sides
be
of the
humble.
Same coin.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan had introduced Ludwig, and so this is my longtime collaborator, and he's scored my movies, including Fruitvale Station and Creed. And all of a sudden, the lights lit up on Kendrick's face, and he said, "You did Fruitvale Station?"
Oh, wow.
And he said, "Yeah." And then the whole room melted away. And then it was just the two of them talking. And then they started talking about Oakland. And it was an incredible experience, which I added nothing to.
Did you know at that point that Kendrick was going to be doing the music for the movie?
No. Okay. No, because I think Robert can talk. We've all had meetings with artists who then their representatives say, "Why would you want to do a superhero movie?
Yeah.
Why would you want to do...
Yeah, this may not fit your brand or whatever.
Yeah, it may not fit your brand, whatever. You don't have time or whatever." But fast forward, he did say yes. And so the crazy part of the story is he was only brought in to do one song.
Wow.
So he was brought in to do one song. And as part of that conversation, he and Coogler continued to talk.
Can I ask, what was the original intent of that meeting? Would you just do one song?
Yes.
Okay.
It was just
nobody
one
had
song.
Said we're going to blow this up to be a whole.
No.
Okay.
So the idea was one song for everything, marketing, the campaign, the whole nine yards. Because at the time, we had just done a Comic-Con piece that had Be Humble in it. Or no, DNA. It had DNA, Kendrick's DNA in it. So, and Coogler had said in the meeting, the release, Kendrick, the release of your records coincide with when I wrote Fruitvale Station, Creed, and Black Panther, and those are the records I listened to while I was writing those movies. Mm. So it was very deep, very quickly. So as part of the conversation about Kendrick doing the single song, Coogler and I started talking, and I said, you know, the guy has got so many great contacts. Everybody wants to be involved with him. And I've always really wanted to make a very pure, real, hey, you know, a T-Bone Burnett, if you will, executive producer, even if it's just the people on Kendrick's label. Mm. And so we proposed it. And he said, yeah, I'll exec produce the record.
Great.
From there, Kendrick would come in. It was, I mean, to work with an artist who's at the very height of their creative powers, and for them to be so unbelievably giving of their time and humble, because usually the way that these things work is you get one song and you never hear from them ever again. And the song isn't even necessarily about the movie, and they put their name on the record and they get a royalty and that's it. That's the end of it. And we were prepared for that to happen. But as we continued and showed him footage, and Ryan Coogler and I and the editor would sit down and show him sequences, and he never wanted to see the whole movie because he's a movie fan. He was like, no, I want to see the movie in the theater when it's done. Mm. Some time went by and we didn't hear anything. About a month and a half went by. He was on tour and then he came back. And then we get a phone call and he says, can you and Ryan come over to the studio? And we went over to this nondescript studio, and having done a lot of hip hop, it didn't have any of the trappings of hip hop. There weren't guys everywhere and, you know, baby mamas and the whole kind of thing. There was three people, and we sat in the studio and he played us 12 or 13 tracks with his scratch vocals on everything.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
Yep.
That fast?
Just turned all that around that fast.
It's crazy. And then really the conversation was, who do you want on the record? And that's when we started talking about how the movie started in Oakland and how all Ryan's movies have a touchstone to Oakland. Mm. We talked about the African continent and how we really wanted artists from there. And then it became this giant collaborative thing where Kendrick picked up the phone and his manager and his the guy who runs his label, they started to pick up the phone. And people were like, sure, I'll be on the track.
Yeah.
And then within a very short time period, I want to say a month maybe, most of the bare bones of the record were done. And that's how it happened. And I had gotten approached separately by Carrie Ann Marshall, who was at Songs at the time. And I she brought Weekend to me, Abel from The Weekend. And so Abel and I started talking, and Abel has an African background. Hmm. So we had a meeting with Coogler, and that's how Weekend kind of got involved. But it was an unbelievable experience.
Are you able to – so all this gets done, and you being representing the film, are you able to say, track two, I don't know, Kendrick. It doesn't really fit.
Yeah, that is a great question. Because of the type of artist that Kendrick Lamar is, and because he was so generous with his time, we went – he looked at things. We showed him – it wasn't like – here's the movie, go make a track. We gave him access to footage whenever he needed. And of course it's Marvel, so you have, you know, it's very careful.
Yeah, that's rare. Footage.
Lockdown.
But we made a very clear decision not to have any censorship on his record. Mm. And he was very respectful of the fact that this was a Marvel movie, which is a division of Disney. We knew we weren't going to make a G-rated record. We wanted it to be a real record in the same way that our movie is not a... a lot of that movie is a social political statement. And so Marvel wasn't afraid of making a record like that. I think Disney was a little bit more,
sure,
understandably, because of the business that they're in. But... We didn't have a lot of censorship on him. So we didn't give, in answer to your question, we didn't give a bunch of notes. Mm-hmm. We weren't like, oh, it should be, you know, 10 BPM faster. Like, none of that went down with him. But that is but the answer to that question is that is a normal part of the process.
I was going
to
say, he's probably a rare example where you're like, we'll let him slide.
There are very few artists that you would, you know, but you're not going to give notes to Scorsese.
Right.
Or to Tarantino, you know, it's unless they ask you, you're not going to. But him and Coogler were in lockstep on the vision side of things.
Did Ludwig do any producing for Kendrick? Because he's notably, for those that don't know, he does Donald Glover, Childish Gambino's music. So he's known in the rap community.
Yeah. So the Ludwig was involved with the entire process because, again, he's a bit of Ryan's muse. Hmm. On everything. So he did do the track that's in the movie, which I'm blanking right now off the top of my head, over the chase sequence. Ludwig produced that track. Most of the tracks were done by Soundwave, who is Kendrick's longtime collaborator.
Interesting.
And then Ludwig would come, and Ludwig was very respectful of the process the way Kendrick wanted to work.
Yeah.
So it's very unusual. It's very pure. It wasn't the way these things can typically go, where it's kind of people arguing over writer line credits and who owns what. None of that happened because when I can't get into too many specifics, but if you can imagine when you get somebody like a Kendrick Lamar or Jay-Z or Kanye or any of those kinds of things, you're talking about a lot of money to make that deal. Even for one song, you're talking about a lot of money, right? Beyonce level money is crazy money. This is an artist who delivered a 12, 13 track record. And of course, as the part of the business side of it, I said, I can't go back to Marvel and ask for tens of millions of dollars for a soundtrack.
Yeah.
And, all I can say is that Kendrick was beyond generous.
I think the most beautiful part of this, strangely enough, besides the money and the impact and the creativity, you had an experience that is maybe the reason that many of us come to this business, which is to be, you know, that phrase that Lin-Manuel Miranda has, in the room where it happened. Just that description of being with Ryan Coogler and Kendrick Lamar in a room talking. These are two of the greatest artists of the early 21st century and maybe for this century. And to be in the room with a filmmaker and a song and an artist, songwriter, composer.
Pulitzer winner.
Yeah. And be a fly on the wall. That, of all the experiences you've had, I know that it might not compare to working on Marmaduke or Cheaper by the Dozen, but that to me is what a great part of your own career to be in the room with those two titans of our culture. Speaking of our culture, you worked on a movie.
Can I
please
say one thing about that?
Yes, I'd like you to.
When I worked on Iron Man, Iron Man was my favorite comic book growing up. And Iron Man gave me, you know, I had a tough childhood sometimes. And Iron Man, in a lot of ways, made me push through. And so when I got to do the film, it was a bit of a childhood dream realized. And I saw the way it inspired so many kids in the same way the comic book inspired me. That movie inspired a lot of kids. You know, it's okay to be smart, and it's okay to be a little punk rock. And, you know, and I remember saying to Kendrick the day before the film came out, he called me, and he was on his way. He was driving back to Oakland. He wanted to be in Oakland when the movie opened.
Wow.
He wanted to be in the theater by his house with his people, you know, he's an Oaklandite his whole life. And I remember saying to him, like, you're going to change so many people's lives tomorrow. Like, and the fact that I got to be involved in a whole bunch of new kids and minorities and, you know, people of color it's overwhelming. It's an overwhelming experience. And to work with these creative giants. But just that point in culture, moving the story forward a little
bit. I used to have somebody I worked with at Fox who would say occasionally when I knew I was having one of those rare, he'd say, bottle this moment.
Yeah.
And I've learned since then that there are certain times, you might get three in a lifetime, you might get one. By the way, shout out to Fruitvale Station, one of my faves. Just
shout
incredible.
Out.
Shout out.
Incredible.
Fruitvale Station, you know who you are.
I'm just shouting out to the station. So the station's going to call me up and say, hey, Robert.
Thanks for the shout out.
Thanks for the shout out. I want to ask you about Guardians for a minute because it flips the script in a way on everything you just said, which is you have a director on Guardians that I imagine had very specific song ideas. And one of the questions I was asked to ask you was, so is that where Dave just kind of goes out and does the paperwork on 12 songs that the director picks, or are you creatively involved in those choices? How does that work on Guardians?
So Guardians is a let me first say that James Gunn is a genius. My very first meeting with James Gunn, I remember it was yesterday, and we sat in the room. It was just James and I, and he said, okay, so you do the music for the Marvel stuff, right? And I said, yeah. And he goes, okay. This one's not going to be the same. It's not going to be like the other ones. We're not going to do what you normally do. And I was like, okay. He said, you're not hearing what I'm saying. He said, there's not going to be any AC/DC. There's not going to be. And I said, oh, okay. And of course, I'm thrilled, right? Because every movie I work on, they're like, yeah, give me AC/DC. So I'm like, great. He goes, no, you're not understanding. He goes, my lead actor is going to sing and dance over a main title sequence to a 1970 song you probably don't know. And I said, what song? And he told me, and I said, well, I do know that song. And then there was like a beat. And I said, wait, are you fucking with me?
Yeah.
And he said, nope, I'm dead serious. And I said, then I'm 100% in.
Great.
Now, because we had made variations of the same superhero movie up to that point. And I remember going to set, and we shot it in outside London. And I remember going to set and looking, and it was inside the prison, and we were doing the on-camera moments. And I remember going, okay, this might be Ice Pirates. This might totally suck. This might be a complete joke.
Ooh.
And then he brought me in very early when the cut came in. Very, very early. I saw a three and a half hour cut of it. And I just remember going, oh my God, I could watch 10 more hours of this footage. Because I hadn't seen anything like it before, let alone the music was fantastic. But the humor and the likability of everybody in the movie was very special. From a creative standpoint, he had picked a lot of the songs. He knew the bucket he was going to pull from.
Yeah.
He had solicited a lot, I think via Twitter, which probably isn't so good anymore, or Facebook at the time or whatever. He had solicited a lot of, he had kind of given some, he didn't tell anybody what
story was about, but he had solicited out in the universe for people that were following him from when he made his trauma movies, ideas. So he had a pretty good bucket, and obviously because the cassette had to fit with his mom and her timeline, he had a pretty good idea. So there were some things that changed around in the movie, but for the most part, it was James picking a lot of the stuff. Marvel at that time also didn't spend money on music. So
yeah, that was kind of a new idea, right? There wasn't really pop songs in the Marvel movies.
Or not for a lot of them.
Well, but it wasn't even pop songs. They didn't spend money on composers either. So a lot of the early composers, Brian Tyler and even Alan Silvestri, and a lot of these, they did things at extremely low numbers. And partly because they were just fans of comic books, and their agents would say, you're never going to do it, and they would do it anyways, which is the same reason I did it, because I wasn't getting paid anything to do the early Marvel movies. It was just the fanboy was like, of course, I'll do it for free. So there were a lot of interesting no's that came on that movie, and a lot of things that had to get turned around. And even more so in the second one, because the movie had been so successful.
No, meaning you would offer a certain price to license a song, that kind of a no?
There were a lot of just denials.
Denials.
Because Marvel, we have to be limited in the way that we give explanations of the scenes they're going to be in. So a lot of people are just not comfortable.
Sounds of the City right now.
Well, that's Marvel actually coming for Dave. Revealing
you've said too much.
or it would be, I don't want there was a lot of one-hit wonders on the first one.
Yeah.
And some people that have one-hit wonders are more precious about their one-hit wonders than the Rolling Stones are about Black and Black, Painted Black. They're like, oh, I don't understand. The woman's green and she's dancing. Like, I'm not comfortable with that. This is my thing.
We went down that path on a lot. Sean Penn wanted to use the Shirley Temple song on the Good Ship Lollipop in a movie, and we had to write a description. It was in a strip club. Denied. So
we went from not sure what the movie was going to be to now it's a ride at Disneyland and things are looking pretty good for you.
Yeah, and there's some great stories about even Marvel. Marvel was 100% committed to the vision, but I think they had made enough money up to that point that if the movie didn't work, it would have been okay. Like we could have made
that's a good place to be too, where they want to try something a little bit.
Oh, that's Marvel.
New, you know?
That's Marvel.
Yeah.
Because we could have made 7 more Iron Mans.
Right.
That's what everybody, just make more Iron Mans and.
But it really broke the mold in many ways on a superhero movie. So thank God you made it.
And it led to being able to make an all black cast Black Panther.
Yeah.
Again, at the height, coming off of Avengers and things like that, you know.
Tell us a little about Format, your company, and how that works.
For our listeners that don't know, Format's the company. It's where we are right now. But it's the company you founded years ago, I guess now. It was shortly after you started working with Marvel and with a handful of other productions, right?
Yeah. Marvel, there are people that, supervisors that came before me, guys like Joel Sill and Bud Carr and the guys at Windswept, where it was a group of supervisors working, and they would have a shared back office. They would have a shared coordinator or shared whatever. Most supervisors act as either one person or one person with an intern or one person with an assistant. Sometimes it's two people with an assistant, and it's always in the garage somewhere. And so, but the funny thing is most supervisors have the same problems. And so, meaning it's not always, oh, I need a great song for this scene. It's, I need a gypsy violin player who will work non-union. Do you know anybody?
Mm-hmm.
And it's for an indie movie. And so my wife is also a music supervisor. And my wife and I didn't work together. We didn't cross streams. But we would sometimes hit each other up for advice on how to do this or that as we went through kind of the process of supervision. So one of the idea, and I was friends with a lot of other supervisors, even though we were competing together. So the idea was, how can we put like-minded people with the same problems in the room together and share back office? That's the very basic concept of format. What format has grown into is we have kind of multiple layers. And as I grew the company, I never wanted to say no to a filmmaker, ever. I don't ever turn opportunities down. So in order to not have to turn down the guy I did a TV pilot for, who's now making a mid-level movie, I had to make sure I had a staff that could handle those movies with me, because that guy making that mid-level movie might be next making the multi-million dollar movie.
Yeah.
Or they're making a multi-million dollar movie and I love them, but now they're making, you know,
perfect
Snapchat.
Yep.
Right.
Movies. So, and but doesn't change the fact that I love them and I want to work with them and I want to support their career, because we all kind of go through cycles and it goes up and down and up and down all over the place. So format was really, I started to team up with some people I was very close with, including Julia Michaels, who used to work for Robert Kraft, who is one of the great supervisors in the business, and Julianne Jordan, who's one of the great supervisors in the business, and Jojo Villanueva, who's now at Sony, who was here with me for 18 years. And then we have multiple layers of supervisors. The other half of our business is we create original content for productions, small productions. And again, it's scaled so we can always help whoever needs the help.
Hmm.
So it's the whole building is built to, like, we all eat lunch together every day at 1. So there's something about, you know, in my building, I have engineers and producers and rappers and singers and writers. So I have this whole bundle of creative energy downstairs that feeds us upstairs, and it keeps everybody current. So we have lots of young people kind of constantly feeding in the shows they went to and the artists that they're into and all that kind of stuff. So that's the idea.
Answers your question about having your finger on the pulse of pop culture.
And speaking of that, we always save this till the end.
Uh-oh.
But we're going to play a little game to test your pop culture knowledge here. Sweeping social media.
What game is that?
Name
that score.
Get ready to play Name That Score, the film music game where a perfect score means you, yes, you, could be a winner. Now let's play Name That Score.
All right. So, Robert, you're right on the mark. This is famous movie songs. We've done this once before. This is version 2. And these all, I think these all precede Dave's experience.
Oh, I was going to say, were they all put in movies by Dave?
Oh, God, don't do that. I can't remember my own movies.
Have a unique advantage and win the game.
They're not all Marvel movies.
This is all the Kendrick Lamar Black Panther songs.
Right. You just have to know them
Although,
backwards.
That would be, that would probably be challenging if you got to
don't play Fat Albert. All those.
So here's the way this works. We play 5 famous film scores, but in reverse, and today it's songs. Robert, Kenny, and Dave will pick from 3 multiple choice answers. The last question is worth double. If anybody gets all 5 right, we give away a prize on our Twitter account at Score the Podcast.
Ooh.
Just mention hashtag name that score.
Wow.
Today's theme is famous movie songs. We have 6 questions here. The songs are much more recognizable than is
scores
some
in
motif
in, reverse,
in a score.
Yeah.
So what we did the first time was we made this more complicated. I don't know if we need to do that this time, but let's try this out for a couple questions. Question 1, is this Lose Yourself from 8 Mile, Eminem, Happy from Despicable Me, Pharrell, or When Doves Cry from Purple Rain?
Oh, these are good choices.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the song titles? Because I have no idea those songs.
Options are Lose Yourself from 8 Mile, Happy from Despicable Me, and When Doves Cry for Purple Rain.
Play backwards.
Eight Mile, Eminem.
Yeah, it's kind of Lose Yourself vibe. Lose Yourself. Ding-a-ding, ding-a-ding.
Ding-a-ding.
Yeah.
All right, so points for everybody.
This song was huge, by the way.
Yeah. Yep.
Man, I'll never forget when that...
It's one of the great...
Spaghetti. When that trailer started playing and that song, you only heard snippets of it. I remember, like, this was like in the Napster period, and it was like, how can we figure out what song that is? Oh, that was like Eminem explosion.
Half the directors I sit with say, you know that there's that Eminem song. I want something like that. I'm like, yeah, yeah, I'm sure you do.
All right, so we all have 1 point. We're moving on to question two. Is this Ghostbusters, Ray Parker Jr. from Ghostbusters, Back in Time from Back to the Future, Huey Lewis and the News, Staying Alive from Saturday Night Fever, the Bee Gees?
You almost don't need to give the clues.
I know. Well, that's maybe we approach that after your answers here. So let's make Robert go first because he's the only one that didn't react.
Yeah, he looks a little confused.
Ghostbusters, Back in Time, Staying Alive.
I thought it was a Staying Alive pocket kind of reversed, but ooh, there's a little Huey Lewis there. But I'm gonna go Staying Alive.
All right. Robert's going Staying Alive.
Dave, earlier you said you and your wife don't cross streams, and I'm gonna go with Ghostbusters.
Nice.
All right, Dave. Ghostbusters, Back in Time, Staying Alive.
Staying Alive.
We all picked different things on this? Is that right?
No, Dave and I went Staying Alive.
He went Ghostbusters.
Oh, well, in that case, everybody missed it.
Huey Lewis?
Oh, man. That was a tricky one because the BPM is pretty similar.
Yeah, well, Huey Lewis and that Ghostbusters song, you know, there's a big lawsuit about when the Ghostbusters song came out.
Right.
Oh, look at you.
So they were built on the similar.
You're giving that lawyer a case.
It wasn't that Huey Lewis song, Ghostbusters.
No, it wasn't. It was...
I Want a New Drug?
Yep,
no, which,
that was
it.
That was it.
Yep. Okay.
All right, so nobody gets points for that.
Oh, man.
We all struck out.
And we're moving on to question three. So I guess we will give the answers.
So then. We were planning on giving away Dave's first edition of Daredevil, but since we missed the question, it's over. Sorry, guys.
Sorry, everybody.
Next three songs.
You can keep it, Dave.
Question three, is this Ghostbusters, again, from Ghostbusters?
We don't have enough movie songs. We got to use them twice. Go ahead.
Don't You Forget About Me
don't
from Breakfast Club, Simple Minds,
yeah,
and Eye of the Tiger from Rocky III.
Oh,
that's so unfair. That's so little.
I got it.
Want to hear it again?
I got it.
Want to hear it
again?
Go
ahead, Robert.
It's easy.
Ghostbusters, Don't You Forget About Me, Eye of the Tiger.
It's Ghostbusters.
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 I want a new drug. When I want things on. When I learn it, don't sing. Gonna land it on. Gonna want a new drug.
I'm just so excited about our... Yeah. We have two guests this week, Huey Lewis and Dave Jordans. Great.
All right, so we are moving on to question four.
Is Ghostbusters part of the next question, too?
Robert's taking
what
shots.
What other Ray Parker Jr. hit?
None. Is this Ghostbusters 2?
Or Karate Kid 3?
Or Huey Lewis?
Question four. Is this Somewhere Over the Rainbow from The Wizard of Oz?
My ringtone. No, I'm just kidding.
When You Wish Upon a Star from
Jiminy
Pinocchio,
Cricket.
Or Singin' in the Rain from Singin' in the Rain.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to say Judy Garland singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Same.
Same.
That one was way too easy.
If you listen to this... I tried to pick the lowest register of the whole song that she sings in. So maybe it would sound like Somewhere Over the Rainbow in there, when that was at the highest register, but didn't really work.
Nope.
Points for everybody. All right.
Did Ray Parker Jr. cover that? I got confused.
Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
I want a new rainbow.
God. All right. Question five. Everybody's tied. So is this Streets of Philadelphia from Philadelphia, Bruce Springsteen, Mrs. Robinson from The Graduate, Simon and Garfunkel, or Live and Let Die from Live and Let Die?
Paul and Linda?
Paul and Wings.
Wings.
Yeah.
Again, Streets of Philadelphia, Mrs. Robinson, or Live and Let Die.
And Live and Let Die. Live and Let Die.
You got to get some of that
karaoke
coffee
with Robert.
I don't know. but I think I'm going to go with what Robert was just yelling out.
Wings.
Wings.
All right. Oh, he's playing the air drums again.
Coming up, we have...
There it is.
All right, so look, we're tied. We have a bonus question. Question six. We usually play this anyway, but it's a good tiebreaker. So here's what we're going to do on these. These are all James Bond songs.
Shirley Bassey, Goldfinger. That's my answer.
Goldfinger! Robert loses. Okay. So
Sam Smith.
I'm not going to give answers for this one.
Skyfall.
So you got to name it, which means Dave may have an advantage here. Or Robert, maybe.
Carly Simon. Go ahead.
Question six. Name that Bond song. All right, hold on a sec. Everybody think of your answers. And we can play it again if you need it. Robert looks
there's
confused.
There's deep thought going on with Dave right now.
Kenny, do you have it? Kenny?
No.
No?
It's like a mid-80s kind of rock guitar Bond song by who would have been a huge
or
British
90s.
Artist.
Yeah. Oh, 90s. You know who it is?
Who?
AC/DC. They really wanted it in the movie, and they got it.
I'm going
I think it's 90s.
Do we want to hear it again?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Chris Cornell.
Wow. Did he do a Bond song?
Yeah.
I love the answer.
Robert's not taking
it. And I love the artist, so I'm going to go with Chris Cornell.
I don't know if you can
this
do
this is
that.
Why we make Robert go first.
I'm saying Chris Cornell. I'm feeling strong. It was kind of a Soundgarden.
I don't know if you get points for that one because we didn't give you the options. Yeah. You're truly piggybacking off the answer.
You
here.
Think? No, I just felt Chris Cornell
I'm
somehow.
Going with GoldenEye.
Kenny's GoldenEye.
Is that a band?
All right. Let's see if you can hear this forward.
If you take life, do you nailed it.
Thank you.
Dave. And kind of Robert.
Not really Robert at all. Just Robert saying Dave Jordan.
But
knows.
We were on the right path right. with the '80s, '90s. But I think he recorded it in the 2000s,
oh,
right?
Wow.
Yeah, I think that. Well, right before I think died, the movie came out in 2006. I want to say Casino Royale. So it would have been early, somewhere in those first few years of the 2000s.
Yeah.
But, all right, you've proven yourself as
band.
A music supervisor.
Yes,
that
so
was the ultimate
I think Dave
test,
just
which
won.
Which means
actually.
Our big winner is.
This is our way of telling you they want you to do the next Bond movie.
Dave Jordan.
I'll do the next Bond movie.
Idris Elba as
I'd
James
do it
Bond.
For free.
Oh, wouldn't that be
I'd
cool?
Do it for
the
free.
Coolest.
So, Dave, I have a question that we thought up, and I've always been curious about this. We usually interview composers. You're the first music supervisor we've had on this podcast. There's always kind of a give and take when you're working with a composer. It's another person with an artistic vision, musical vision. How often, a lot of movies have that big music moment, a montage or, you know, this you know, the character in their deepest place in a movie. How often is that a song and a composer says, no, Dave, give me that. I want to try to score that. Because I feel that's like a dream come true kind of a sequence for a composer. But I would assume a lot of times it's a song that a director has a vision to fit there.
Well, it just, boy, it really depends. It depends on the movie, depends, you know, again, we can talk about Marvel Universe is very specific about the way they use those things. We like to hit our big superhero moments with a big score.
Yep.
So that's usually the way it is. On Panther, obviously we did that, but we also used a song over a big montage. So
yep.
It really depends.
Do composers ever try to take back some scene that...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Composers will try to take it back, or sometimes we'll push things onto the composer because we can't afford the song
right.
that's been in there.
I've
and...
been in a couple where there's almost a subtle competition. Everybody, mm-hmm. you try and find a song, and you try and score it, and you don't know till the end which one becomes the winner.
Really?
And I think this is probably true when you were at Fox, too. On superhero movies, there's legacy themes. So sometimes, you know, most composers never want to do the theme from the first movie.
Right. You get that always John like, Williams sequel.
Right. They're like, yeah. I want to do it, but I can do it better. And let me have an opportunity and let me try. And sometimes that works. And sometimes you're like, no, we want to stay on brand and let's stay with the theme. So
yep.
It just, it's a big thing with sequel movies.
That's interesting.
Good question, Matt.
We're just sitting here chatting about this, but I would assume the passion that we see from composers who say, are you kidding me? That montage of someone's entire life passing, you know, and like, that's a dream, but like, that's song territory,
you
too.
You want to use Radiohead and not my...
Right.
You know, it just depends. It depends how I feel about it.
Yeah.
That's right.
I have no problem. I don't care. If they don't want to put a song in there, I don't care. If the score is going to make me cry, I don't care. Take the song out.
Yeah,
the
and
song
I think
does the emotion.
The answer actually comes full circle on this episode, because one of the things you want to approach this whole issue with is, who are you going to call?
God. Oh. I knew this wasn't going to be like realistic.
Try the veal. Don't forget to tip your waitress.
I'll be the first to say that this has been really interesting, a really interesting conversation as somebody who doesn't come from the, you know, the studio world behind closed doors. I think it was really cool to bring what you do to the forefront and let the listeners know.
Because
there's so much to it, and we never hear about this part of it. We see the movie, we hear the music, but so much work goes into it. We want to thank you for coming on the show, Dave.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Studio audience, thanks you as well.
Thank you so much.
We want to remind our listeners, we're continuing to grow and we need your help growing. Go on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform, rate and review, and also be sure to follow us on Twitter at @ScoreThePodcast.
Thank you so much. And Matt, Kenny, I also want to say what a joy to be with you. DJ, my main man, Dave Jordan, teaching us all about the inside world of music supervision. Thanks for joining us on Score the Podcast. We will see you next week.